Today on Dialogue, remembering a favorite son of Champaign, Urbana.
1979. I remember when hip-hop came to Champaign.
People remember William Patterson's life and his commitment to STEM education.
Mm-hmm. And that was his mission to touch as many youth and adults mm-hmm. as possible.
I mean, he's in the forefront of all of that work and making sure that our community is connected.
Plus new efforts to help Central Illinoisans afford new advancements in sickle cell treatment. And a Champaign-Urbana man becomes the first to teach a Japanese art form.
I'm challenging what I would call the hegemony of Western ideas in art education. There are more ideas.
I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue from Illinois Soul starts right after the news. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m., we're bringing you interviews and stories connected to Black communities in Central Illinois. People across Central Illinois are remembering Dr. William Patterson, also known as Dr. P. The 58-year-old educator passed away unexpectedly. I interviewed Patterson in 2021 at one of our News, Brews, and Beats events, and he was a member of the Community Advisory Board for the formation of Illinois Soul. From my experience and from talking to people about his life and legacy, Patterson was passionate about science and service. William Patterson grew up in the racially segregated north end of Urbana. He proudly claimed he was from the ghetto because he saw talent all around him. One of the cultural movements from the ghettos of New York City found him in Central Illinois, as he recounted in a 2017 TED Talk at the U of I.
1979. I remember when hip-hop came to Champaign and actually was in the halls of Urbana Junior High School, and this big kid named Kane Beaumont, this white kid, he had this boombox radio, right? And he comes bumping down the halls, and he got Rapper's Delight on the box.
I said, the hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
Now, I was stunned, not only because the song was on fire, number one, right? Song was hot, right? But the boombox, the technology was banging too, right? I said, I gotta do that. I have to do that.
As a child, Patterson and his friends would run after school to local STEM programs.
We're in sixth and seventh grade. We run up after school, and we want to get to the Plato terminals because there's a math program there. Because of National Science Foundation being part of that, they put that technology in my community, and it made a difference.
But in the 1980s, federal funding for the programs was cut.
I was used to having programs like the Douglas Center Drum Corps happening in my community. I was used to having movies in my park and dreaming about being in the drum corps, watching the movie, playing softball, doing all these things where I saw folks in my community rising beyond our marginalized spaces.
Living in an under-resourced neighborhood left him angry and without direction.
So I started getting equipment any way that I could, but the way I was doing it was the wrong way. So 2 years after I graduated from high school, I went to penitentiary. Went to penitentiary for 2 years, trying to figure out what my ghetto genius meant.
Childhood friend Tracy Parsons says Patterson began turning his life around while behind bars.
And he vowed, being in the jail cell, that he was gonna be a difference maker.
After marrying his high school sweetheart, Lori Gold, Patterson earned degree after degree while raising a growing family, eventually a PhD in education policy studies from the University of Illinois. But Parsons said he didn't stop there.
He's the most creative person I know and I've ever met. And so when you talk about work today around STEM and STEAM, AI, artificial intelligence, I mean, he's in the forefront of all of that work and making sure that our community is connected to that work and the importance of the work and trying to hold the university accountable for making sure that these services, supports, programs are in the community.
Through the years, Patterson held leadership positions with the Bruce Nesbitt African American Culture Center, the Urban League, and at the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club in Champaign, always finding a way to merge his love of technology, media, and community service.
I was at the Housing Authority, he was at the Urban League, so our paths crossed because of a lot of programs.
Sonia Holly is the Director of Human Resources for Student Affairs Administration at the U of I. More than 20 years ago, she worked with Patterson to give a voice to young Black women on local radio.
Welcome back. This is All Girls Radio. Is this Jazzy holding it down?
We started working together on a show called All Girls Radio, which was geared towards middle school, primarily middle school girls. We had a few high school girls, but teens and preteens. And so we were teaching the girls how to do a radio show, how to produce a radio show, how to write, how to do research.
In All Girls Radio, we always bring technology into our show, into the topics of our show. Will you have any technology into your workshop?
Yeah, there's a web design workshop.
Several years ago, Patterson brought a brightly colored rehabilitated school bus to neighborhoods to teach children about careers in STEM using drones, race cars, and hip-hop. In December of 2021, he explained how the idea was born at an Illinois Public Media News Brews and Beats event.
Hip-Hop Express exists because a vehicle showed up in my neighborhood when I was a kid in Douglas Park by the name of Disco Rat that had a vehicle. And he played in the park and taught us how to DJ. And so we knew that there was a living example of that.
Reverend Willie Comer Jr. witnessed how bringing science to a neighborhood made a difference.
You can hope all day, but if you don't have access to hope,
speak it,
then you just have hope deferred.
Yeah.
See, for me, hope is last week when I had 30 kids from Edison outside racing RC cars. $200-$300 RC cars racing, and you saw those kids when they won, like they won the championship, the state championship in basketball.
In 2020, Mikhail Smoot was working on remote control cars in a store when he met Dr. Patterson. At the time, he was unsure of what he wanted to do with his life. Smoot now lives in Arizona, working as a cement truck operator, setting foundations for new buildings using remote controls. He told my colleague David Pierce that Dr. Patterson ultimately helped him find his purpose.
I mean, I was helping people, you know, beforehand. But he made me actually want to help the younger generation.
He encouraged all of us to stay encouraged about our community and making a difference and being in the forefront of change.
Parsons says Patterson wanted children who grew up in the neighborhoods like he did to know their value.
As he got his doctorate, he then became Dr. P. So he often talked about Dr. Dre and how he had come up and how he had changed the world so that young folks could know that it could be done.
With more memories of Dr. William Patterson, joining me in studio now is Sonia Holly, Director of Human Relations for the Student Affairs Administration at the University of Illinois, and Stacy Robinson, Associate Professor of Graphic Design and Illustration at the U of I, both worked with Patterson in the community.
I really followed Dr. P around. Whenever he told me to show up, I showed up whenever I could, and especially for the Ghetto Genius Universe work, because I'd never seen anything like it before. I watched him talk about the Ghetto Genius Universe and what he wanted to do, then I watched him build it.
And for people who don't know, what is the Ghetto Genius Universe?
The Ghetto Genius Universe is, well, it's a collection of individuals and activities that looks at the multifaceted media of hip-hop and with all of its facets, and it breaks it down to a community level where everyone in the community can take part in it and enter into building hip-hop as a culture from their vantage point. And so for me, as a visual artist, I entered in bringing the type of art that I make, the digital collages that I make, the drawings that I make. I was able to participate in the Ghetto Genius Universe by simply drawing with the young people. I would come to the camp and I would show them what I would do. They would show me what they could do. And everybody who came came with their particular love, their skill set. There were a lot of makers there. There were people there who were making Bluetooth speakers. There were people there who were learning how to DJ. There were people there who were learning how to resolve conflict in the most interesting ways as well.
And I might add that that's how Our Girls Radio Show was designed too. He had hip hop on the forefront of the brain.
Always.
That was our music during our interludes, during our breaks. Hip hop was embedded in All Girls Radio as well.
Why do you think that was?
I mean, we're all hip hop kids, I think, you know, so I think it was, that's what we know, that's what we grew up on. And
Dr. P understood that hip hop was an institution that had the capabilities of supplying every need that the community needs. And that vision came from understanding the culture and the history of hip hop, understanding where it came from and its very beginnings in the late 60s and early 70s, to what it has become now with hip hop, breakdancing, going to the Olympics, right?
I believe that he had a vision for, you know, a bunch of programs because he knew that this program would touch this group. This program and idea would touch that group. Mm-hmm. And that was his mission to touch as many youth and adults as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because he was always thinking, if you even if you gave him an idea.
Right.
No, in the time I've been here, and certainly in the last couple of years, they've talked a lot about the town and gown situation with the university and its relationship to the Black community in Champaign-Urbana. But he really broke that down.
You know, we might sit around and talk about the town and gown divide, and we'll have a lot of DEI meetings about that and ways of thinking about that and breaking that down, talking about what we should do. We'll have a lot of meetings. Dr. P was not about having a lot of meetings.
Yes.
Dr. P would have one meeting, and then he would make that thing happen. And the thing would be happening, and then you would show up. And you're like, oh, well, I thought we were still meeting. He's like, no, we already had the meeting. I told you what we're doing.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
And that, and he was very much about that. So he wasn't about the divide because he came from the community.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of people who are associated with the university don't come from here. They're not really a part of the community. They weren't born and raised here. They came here for the job.
Or
for school, absolutely. Yep. And then when they might leave here and go somewhere else for another job or another school or something else. But Dr. P was born and raised here. He is the community. He knows everybody.
Yes, and they know him.
And they know him. And he exemplifies the same things that we constantly meet about and don't do.
We know and we can see the legacy of Dr. William Patterson everywhere, and we know that will live on.
Mm-hmm.
What is the charge for the rest of us who are here now to help his legacy live on?
The famous quote, don't stop, and it don't stop.
And it don't stop.
If it comes to mind,
it won't stop.
Push through, see it to the end. Because he was always, you know, every mentoring program I was a part of over the years, he was trying to convince me every step of the way, you should oversee it. No, you need to oversee it. You need to be overseeing. I'm just like, nah, I'm okay with being in the background. No. He was always pushing. And I think that we're going to have to use that. Whatever we want to do, whatever we think about, push through it, get it done. Yeah.
I was thinking about this. This is a great question because I was thinking the first thing that we're going to have to do is really understand his vision. I want to read where that vision is written down and what his plans are. And it's going to take a team of dedicated individuals. As the expression goes, many hands make light work. And Dr. P's work is not light.
No.
It will take a lot of us. But I think the first thing that we would have to do is really understand his vision for the legacy he wanted to leave. and his vision for getting there.
Sonia Holly and Stacey Robinson, thank you for sharing such candid conversation about Dr. William Patterson, and my condolences to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thoughts at Illinois Public Media are also with Dr. Patterson's wife, Lori, his three children, and granddaughter, and his sister. If you'd like to share a memory of Dr. Patterson, please leave a voicemail on our Illinois Soul hotline at 217-244-1989. Again, the number is 217-244-1989. The public is invited to remember William Patterson on Sunday, April 14th from 3 to 7 p.m. at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. In lieu of flowers, the family asked people to support William's STEAM genius, NFP. And in his honor, we'll go to break playing one of his favorite songs, Free by Denise Williams.
For us.
From Illinois Soul, I'm Kennedy Vincent. Here's some events going on around town. The Boneyard Arts Festival gets underway on April 12th. Experience visual performance and other forms of art throughout Champaign-Urbana. Are you an inspiring writer? Get advice on creative writing at the Red Herring Fiction Workshop on Sunday, April 13th at 4 p.m. at the Urbana Free Library. Also, the University of Illinois Black Chorus will perform its annual Mom's Day concert at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The performance starts at 7:30 p.m. Let us know what's happening. Send an email to illinois-soul@illinois.edu.
Welcome back to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Last month, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an executive order aimed at creating better access to new advanced drugs and treatments for diseases like sickle cell. Pritzker says his goal is to make more expensive therapies affordable and available in Illinois.
If we can narrow the affordability gap, those who are suffering from these diseases won't have to wait a generation before they can access these groundbreaking cures. Indeed, I hope they won't have to wait more than a year.
More than 40% of sickle cell patients in Illinois are on Medicaid. We wanted to know about the status of this disease in 2024 and whether the advanced drugs and treatments are here in central Illinois. I had a dialogue with Dr. Connie Picone, a member of the Pediatrics Specialties for Carle Foundation Hospital. We talked about the advancements and modern challenges the dozens of people she treats for sickle cell face.
I am Dr. Picone. I am the pediatric hematologist oncologist here at Carle. I'm the director of our Pediatric Sickle Cell Anemia Center, and I'm also the associate medical director for pediatric specialties. I started at Carle in September 2020, so I've been here a little over 3.5 years.
So what is the easiest way to explain sickle cell disease?
So sickle cell disease is a chronic blood disorder. So you can think about it kind of in two ways. It's a problem with the red blood cells. Your red blood cells are the cells that carry the oxygen around your body. And so in the case of sickle cell disease, the first problem is your body doesn't make enough of them. So that's when we use the word anemia. Most people have heard that word. And that's when your red blood cell levels aren't at the kind of normal levels where we want them to be. But the other part is these abnormally shaped cells or sickle cells. Normal red blood cells are shaped like round, kind of flexible donuts, is kind of how I describe them to my pediatric patients. The sickle cells, on the other hand, are curved or C-shaped or sickle-shaped, and that's where historically the name came from, because when they're not getting the oxygen that they need, they transform from those normal round cells into those sickle cells. And the combination, so to speak, of the anemia and the abnormally shaped cell is in large part why we see a lot of the problems and complications we do.
You know, as we were talking earlier, it is predominantly in Black communities. Any particular reason why? Obviously with genetics is a big part to play with that.
Yeah, so sickle cell disease is a genetic or an inherited disorder, which means it runs in families. So it's not something that you get like a germ or a virus, right? It is inherited from your mom or your dad or both. We know that sickle cell disease is most prevalent in areas around the world where malaria is prevalent. So back in the 1950s in this country, they figured out that the gene or the DNA that codes for this certain protein in sickle cell disease was changed or mutated, modified, because those individuals who carried sickle cell trait actually were protected somewhat from getting malaria infection. So if you look at a map of the world, for example, of where we see malaria most often, and then you look at where we see sickle cell most often, those maps are going to be identical.
And it's not exclusive, however, to Black communities.
Correct, exactly. So while we do see it predominantly in the African American community here in the United States, we do also see it in Hispanic Americans, but it really can be really anyone. So, you know, it's important to talk about it not only within the Black community, but as a community at large, because it's something that I think we all need to be aware of.
Is there a certain age or what are the symptoms that people that you look out for as doctors or maybe a pediatrician or a general practitioner that says, okay, maybe you should go and be screened?
So in fact, we screen all babies. So you can't get out of it, so to speak. So, which is a very good thing. So back in the early 80s, there was a study done looking at giving antibiotics, just something as simple as penicillin twice a day, every day, to children with sickle cell disease. And what they found was it was actually life-saving. One of the most serious problems in sickle cell disease is a very high risk for infection with certain kinds of germs or bacteria. And so when we instituted antibiotic prophylaxis, we call it, so giving kids penicillin every day, that really changed the landscape of sickle cell disease at that time. Kids were now living well into their teens and adulthood and even, you know, into their 20s, 30s, 40s, because we were able to manage or help to prevent those very serious infections. So then children weren't dying of infection. So now in the United States, all 50 states will screen infants at birth.
I remember growing up in the 80s that you would hear either it was extremely painful to have sickle cell disease, and it really reduced your life expectancy. Is that still the case, or how do you figure that?
So pain is the most common complication that we see in sickle cell disease. And the reason for that is kind of multifold, meaning there are a lot of different reasons. But again, when you have those sickle cells, they don't flow the way they're supposed to. They don't flow through blood vessels as freely and as easily as the healthy red blood cells do. So they kind of get stuck. You know, I tell my patients it's kind of like a traffic jam. So, you know, when the cells get stuck, they block that flow of blood, and then the oxygen, the nutrients, everything that you want to get all around the body, you know, what your blood is supposed to be doing, the body's not able to do that. And that in part is what causes the pain, and it can be very debilitating. And thankfully, we have a medication that's been around for many decades now called hydroxyurea, which is truly a wonderful medicine when it comes to decreasing, in general, the problems and complications that we see from sickle cell disease. So we start that medicine very early on now, actually before children turn a year of age. And when we do that, then you can prevent all of the problems from happening, and so we can prevent all of these complications. Despite that, though, I will say individuals with sickle cell disease still do not live as long as, you know, their counterparts, as people who don't have sickle cell disease. So the average lifespan is still kind of in the 50s. So, you know, we obviously still have a lot more work to do. And some of these newer therapies that are, you know, have been introduced and approved are hopefully going to help us to do just that.
So what are the new therapies, and are you using some of them, or are they targeted to certain age groups? Or?
Yeah, so medication-wise, there have been three medications that have been FDA-approved in sickle cell disease. Two of them are kind of tailored more towards prevention, so to speak, decreasing the complications of sickle cell disease. One medicine is a medicine that's given as kind of an infusion through an IV, and that one was targeting more the pain, those painful crises that we were talking about, so helping to decrease that. Beyond the medicines, our kind of latest, you know, late breaking news, so to speak, is the FDA approved in December of 2023, so just a few months ago, gene therapy, two gene therapy options for sickle cell disease. These treatments are curative, meaning, you know, unlike the medicines that we have for sickle cell disease, which are just going to help, you know, again, to modify things, right, you know, to help to kind of prevent complications. These newer therapies that have been approved are going to be a cure for sickle cell disease, which is amazing. Right now, they are approved in patients 12 years of age and older, and for certain types of sickle cell disease, for our more severe types, so to speak. But we have a lot of work to do when it comes to now the kind of practical everyday, right? Being able to identify how we're going to get these treatments covered. They're very expensive, as you might imagine. You know, where patients are going to be able to go. Here at Carl, I don't have all of the resources I need to be able to offer gene therapy. So, you know, I would send patients up to Chicago or St. Louis, you know, places like that. So how can we, as a community, and, you know, specifically as a medical community, advocate for all of our patients so we know that these therapies that have now been approved are going to be accessible to everybody?
How many patients do you treat here in Carl?
So I have about 60 patients with sickle cell disease that I see between the ages of like 2 months and, well, my big kids are 19 years old.
I asked Dr. Percone how she reassures parents who are concerned about their children developing sickle cell disease.
I think one of the things that sometimes can make it hard is that many parents still are unaware of their trait status, we call it, you know, so they don't know if they're a carrier. As an example, if each parent has sickle cell trait, there's a 25% chance that they will have a child with sickle cell disease. So, and that's with every pregnancy. But if one parent doesn't have anything, you know, is not a carrier of anything, then there is never going to be a situation where they would have a child with sickle cell disease. So again, you know, part of talking about this for me is really just the talking about it, you know, making sure that we are having these conversations and ask to get tested and, you know, have these conversations with each other, with their partner, with their families, with their doctors, you know, with their medical providers. I mean, all of that, so that we are in a place where people are knowledgeable, you know, going into, you know, a pregnancy and having children and things like that.
How do you get screened for sickle cell, and should all adults who, even if they haven't thought about it, or in particular in the Black community?
So it's a very simple blood test that sometimes the health department or at kind of community health fairs, things like that, you can certainly kind of call the health department and ask. I think they can do it. Otherwise, just your primary provider to reach out to them. That's also, easy. And again, it's a very simple blood test to do.
The Centers for Disease Control released a report in 2021 that said the maternal mortality rate for Black women is twice as high as it is for white women in the United States. There have been many testimonies and news reports about doctors ignoring the pain of Black people in hospitals. I asked Dr. Percone of Carle Health if physicians are sensitive enough to understand when a Black patient's pain complaints may warrant a test for sickle cell disease.
So that's a good question. Generally, when women are pregnant, they should be screened for sickle cell disease. That doesn't happen all the time. You know, we do have a large community here that that was not born in this country, so wouldn't have necessarily had a newborn screen. They're starting newborn screening in certain countries in Africa, but it's not as well defined, so to speak, or well standardized as it is in the United States. So, you know, certainly thinking about these things, you know, as they're, you know, caring for a pregnant woman are very important. And I do think there is awareness. I think like a lot of things related to sickle cell, I think we need to continue to work on enhancing and improving that awareness.
There is a large African-American community here. There's also a large Congolese mm-hmm. community here. Do you see sickle cell patients in both communities or?
Yes. Yes, I do. It is, you know, it's interesting again because, you know, it really gives you an idea of the lack of resources and treatments, you know, even when it comes to, again, these simple, you know, penicillin, amoxicillin. Outside of the United States, you know, treatment of sickle cell disease is very different, particularly in underserved countries, because they don't have access to all of the medical care that we do have available here. So, you know, even things like blood transfusions can be very difficult, you know, when you're in places where they don't have, you know, they just don't have those resources available to them. So.
And where do you give blood? Maybe if you're new to town and you don't know where to go, and do you come right here to Carle, or can you go to Impact? Or
so Impact, I would say, would be the best thing, and that's just down the road here. They come here to Carle, which is great, so I get to donate too when I have the opportunity. But yeah, they have blood drives everywhere.
As a pediatrician, what does a cure look like?
I mean, it's amazing, right? I mean, it's more than anything I can offer now with the medicines that we have. There's a lot, right, that comes with having a chronic illness. And, you know, to be able to give kids that, you know, that freedom, so to speak, from having to think about that every day and knowing that, you know, they can, again, that they're healthy, they don't have sickle cell disease anymore, they can, you know, grow up and have kids and, you know, live a good long life. I mean, it's amazing.
My thanks for that dialogue with Dr. Connie Pacone, a member of the Pediatric Specialties for Carle Foundation Hospital, talking about treatments for sickle cell disease here in central Illinois. Coming up, we'll meet the Illinoisan who is becoming the first U.S. professor to teach a traditional Japanese comic art.
Of putting manga in there, a form that usually doesn't belong in fine arts spaces, in academic spaces. So, it feels really good to be able to be myself in the museum finally.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. You're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the Black communities of central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hardwick. What does a popular form of traditional Japanese comic art dating back to the 19th century have to do with central Illinois? Well, for one resident, it means becoming the first professor and Black man in the United States to teach students how to draw manga art. Kofi Bazell Smith is a Master of Fine Art student at the University of Illinois School of Art and Design. His art career explores these themes after a childhood fascination ultimately led him to Japan and learning the language. His latest and final exhibit at the Krannert Art Museum opens on Saturday, April 6th. Illinois Public Media's Kennedy Vincent recently spoke with Kofi Bazell Smith about his journey.
Kofi, let's talk about how all of this started. You said you had a childhood fascination with Japanese art. How did that come about?
I saw Dragon Ball Z on TV, the anime, when I was a little kid. I was mesmerized by it. I just started drawing the scenes that I saw on TV, and immediately I was like, this is just what I want to do. I was like 6 or 7 years old.
What was the inspiration behind choosing manga versus another form of traditional Japanese art?
It just happened to be the first thing that had an impact on me. So when I saw anime, when I was drawing manga, I didn't know it was Japanese. I just saw these cartoons and I was like, I knew it was something different. It wasn't Bugs Bunny. There was something special about it. So all I was doing was copying that. My parents started buying me manga. That was like my first introduction, my first interaction with art.
When did you realize that you wanted to pursue art in higher education?
Yeah, you know, that took a long time. I used to get in trouble in school a lot for drawing manga in class. I never took art classes. I just taught myself how to draw. I never thought to major in art. It just never crossed my mind. I didn't know it was something you could do. You can't learn how to draw manga anywhere in the United States. There's no courses on that. There's no schools that teach how to make manga. So it just never felt like an option for me. So I dropped out. Fast forward to I'm 28 years old. I had already went to Japan. You know, I dropped out of school a bunch of times and I was like, let's do this manga thing. So I just decided to buckle down and major in studio art.
Manga is an art form that has so much history. It's a style that dates back to the 19th century in Japan. How did manga first start?
So you could say it's really sort of started to take off in the early 1900s. This is debated for some reason among Western scholars, but people in Japan are pretty clear. There's a long scroll called Choju Jinbutsu Giga, which roughly translates into picture of frolicking anthropomorphic animals. There's no words. It's just a bunch of rabbits and toads and monkeys just doing stuff. And Choju Giga was made by an artist by the name of Toba in the 12th or 13th century. They're not sure. It's just a long scroll of animals. And that inspired a genre called Toba-e. E means picture, right? Pictures like Toba. Early on in Japan, in like the 17th and 18th centuries, printing presses took off. And it was the first time you see a lot of art prints being sold, like, to the public. And it was a lot of Toba-e. And this is what we historians sort of consider like the earliest form of manga. But at the time, it was more like cartoony, sort of like gag drawings. It wasn't like sequential art in a narrative format. After that, in the late 1700s, there was something called kibyoshi, which roughly translates into yellow books. It was collections of 10-page narrative books. So this is the first time you see like word and image together to tell a story. The very first repeating narrative character in world history was in Japan, a character by the name of Manimon during this era. And actually, when comics finally came to Japan, it was by way of an Englishman named Charles Wergman. In 1861, he came to Yokohama and he started the very first comics magazine called Japan Punch. And he introduced word bubbles and the idea of like bracketing comics into panels into Japan. At the time, manga, the term comes from, it means whimsical pictures. So ga means picture, mon means whimsical. At the time, that just meant sketches, like funny sketches. It wasn't until the early 20th century, early 1900s, a cartoonist by the name of Rakuten Kitazawa was considered the very first professional Japanese cartoonist and the first mangaka, and that's when manga meant sort of comics.
As we listen to you speak about the history of manga, we also hear you speaking Japanese. Are you self-taught?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. So the first time I learned Japanese, actually, so I dropped out of university, dropped out of U of I, and then my parents were like, well, you got to do something. So they made me go to community college. They were like, you got to go study something at Parkland College. My dad was like, you like that anime stuff. Why don't you study Japanese? Just on a whim, I took the Japanese course. And for some reason, I just started getting straight A's. I was really into it. So I did 2 years of official courses. After that, I started attending Japanese conversation tables on U of I campus. Even though I was a dropout, I would still show up to the tables. and studying on YouTube and like memorizing Japanese music, memorize a bunch of songs. And then I would just look up the words after I figured out. I'd be singing, didn't know what it said. And then I would just look up the words and just build my vocabulary that way.
When did you first travel to Japan?
The first time I traveled to Japan was when I was 27. So I was a dropout, dropped out of college like three times, had a 1.7 GPA. I was working another dead-end job. I used to work at like factories, all kind of stuff. I was working at a temp job, and I was kind of like, all right, I got to do something. So I hired a private language tutor, started saving money for the first time, saved up $5,000, and quit my job and flew to Japan for a month to go study manga, and I joined a boxing gym while I was there. And that was sort of life-changing, and that motivated me to go back to school when I got back home.
How did the first trip to Japan change the trajectory of how you looked at your life, but also how did it impact your art and also the art of boxing?
It was a big deal for me because I had never really traveled that far out of my hometown. And then going all the way to Japan, it sort of showed me what I was capable of. And, you know, I went by myself. And, you know, I was around people who didn't speak English, so it really catapulted my language level. So, I trained at a boxing gym there, and I've learned more Japanese at boxing gyms than I have in a classroom. It's not like a book. A book doesn't show you how people really talk. And I also learned a lot about the differences between American and Japanese boxing styles. And I learned that I could incorporate some of the Japanese boxing into my style. So it was a really... really huge shift for me in terms of seeing myself as somebody who's like a cultural ambassador and understanding culture and language and art and martial arts all is like weaving together.
You call yourself a U.S.-Japan bridging scholar, mm-hmm. and also you see yourself as a cultural ambassador. Tell us more about that.
The first time I went to Japan, like I said, I saved up a bunch of money. I came back so broke. I was hurting. I didn't have a job. I just left my job, and I was like, I'll figure it out when I get back. I was gone for a month, came back, couldn't find a job. I was struggling. I was still going to the Japanese conversation tables, but when everybody would go off to eat, I would just be like, nah, I'm not hungry. I'm good, right? So I was struggling. So I decided, okay, next time I go to Japan, somebody else is going to pay for it. I'm not paying for this. So then I got myself back into community college. Like I said, I had a 1.7 GPA. Trash. I had so many Fs. I had straight A's in Japanese. But I had Fs in like everything else. I would just stop going to class. So I just grinded for like three semesters to pull my GPA up to a 2.0. Because I found out in order to get a visa to work in Japan or live in Japan or spend more time in Japan, you need a bachelor's degree in something. So I was like, okay, I got to go back to school. I love that place. I want to go back. As soon as I got to undergrad, I went to the study abroad office. And I was like, how do I study abroad? And I figured that out and I applied to study abroad and then I went and I didn't pay for it. So I went back to Japan and one of the scholarships that I got was called the U.S.-Japan Bridging Scholarship. And it's all about creating exchange between the U.S. and Japan through undergrads.
Have you done any community events with the art of manga?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of different things to a professional mangaka in Tokyo when I went back, and I brought him. I created an artist residency for him at University of Illinois, applied for a grant, got a bunch of money, and I brought him here for 2 weeks, brought him to my old middle school. And yeah, he taught a bunch of kids stuff about manga. He doesn't speak English, so I was like the Japanese to English interpreter. And that was the first time last year, around this time last year, I really felt like, okay, I'm actually doing bridging work. I've been thinking about it and talking about it, and I finally like found a way to make that happen. Because not only are they learning manga, they're learning about another culture. They're learning about another language. He brought his daughter here, and I got her temporary enrollment in a middle school, so we got to, you know, have some connections between some kids and stuff. So I was like, okay, that's kind of where that came from and how that's been manifesting.
Now that you're going for your MFA, Master of Fine Arts, mm-hmm. this is the end of your education process.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Man, it's been a long, long process. Many years in and out of school. It's a bit surreal, but I am ready to be done. It's been great, especially these past few years. But yeah, I'm ready to move on.
After you graduate, you are embarking upon the next phase of your manga art career and journey. You are going to be the first professor in the country to teach people how to draw manga.
I'm not the first person who teaches about manga, but I'll be the first professor that teaches students how to draw it, how to make it.
You're taking your appreciation for the art form and you're paying it forward by teaching others. How does that feel, and what is the response you're getting back from students and the community?
Yeah, so I love it. So it's interesting. One thing they don't tell you when you major in art or when you take art classes or when you take art history, you're not taking art history, you're taking Western European art history, right? And when you take art, you're learning Western European art styles. There's a lot of other kinds of art. If you only took these art history courses that they give us, you would think that art started in Italy. And humans have been making art for a very long time. So part of what I'm doing beyond just teaching manga is I'm introducing a non-Western form. I'm challenging what I would call the hegemony of Western ideas in art education. There are more ideas. And the reception has been great. I travel all around the country doing workshops, teaching about manga, doing lectures, talking about the history of the form, doing residencies. I've been to so many universities and schools with little kids. Every single place I go, some student tells me that their teacher didn't like them drawing manga. And part of the issue is it's not a part of the Western canon, right? It's not the normal way how we learn how to draw. We all start with observation, representation, very much a hearkening back to the sort of like French and Italian Renaissance era. But there's other ways to draw. There's other ways to make work.
You've experienced some barriers drawing manga, but have you also experienced barriers as a Black man studying this form of art?
Surprisingly, the barriers that I've experienced being Black have probably been in the U.S. It's the amount of acceptance that I've got in Japan has been incredible. It's interesting. It doesn't mean that racism or like stereotypes and stuff don't exist in Japan, but it's not like the United States. Most of it comes from just not knowing and not having any contact. And it's an extremely homogenous place. And a lot of those barriers and those walls are passed over by speaking the language. People really appreciate when you take the time to learn their language and understand their cultures. I've spent a day with one of the most famous mangaka in history, Tetsuya Chiba. He's like 80-something years old. He made the most famous boxing manga of all time, Ashita no Joe. Took pictures with him and everything. People have been really receptive.
It's your last show in Champaign.
Yeah.
What can guests look forward to when they visit your exhibit? Mm-hmm. And how does it feel to have your last show be here?
It feels great. So I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, and I remember being a kid, my parents dragging me out to the art museum, and I hated it because I didn't get it. And now I have a show in the museum, and I finally appreciate it. And the place I used to get dragged to going, and I didn't understand the art. But I also like it because I'm putting comics in there. Now I'm putting manga in there, a form that usually doesn't belong in fine arts spaces, in academic spaces. So it feels really good to be able to be myself in the museum finally. What people can expect, you've never seen a comics or manga exhibition like this. It's gonna be dope.
Kofi, thank you so much for joining me and congratulations on all of your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That was IPM's Kennedy Vincent talking with Kofi Bazell-Smith, Master of Fine Art student at the University of Illinois School of Art and Design. His exhibit is running until April 20th at the Krannert Art Museum. You can find out more information by going to our website, illinoissoul.org. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are brought to you by Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have a dialogue with you again next week.